Welcome to Inspired. In today's episode, I'm delighted to have as my guest, Garth Sandiford. Garth's mission in life is to impact the lives of 2 billion people daily. He's the founder of the Daily Gratitude Movement. He's an empowerment coach, a Tony Robbins trainer. He's about to bring out a book called Gratitude Transform, From Darkness to Light. And to add a bit more flavor, he is the son of the former Prime Minister of Barbados, Sir Lloyd Erskine Sandiford. That's quite a lot.
You know, it's funny. There were people in my life that knew me for probably like 10, 15 years that never knew that about me. It was not something I actually talked about. As a matter of fact, I avoided talking about it. I think it was because I didn't ever want anyone to feel like I was better than them, and I didn't want anyone to treat me differently. So I was low-key about it. And I also think that there was just like a little bit of fear, because once people know that, it's like, okay, I can't really be myself. Being here in Barbados now, there are many things that I would love to do that I can't do. I don't think I could do, because our family is a name that stands out. People know who we are. And so I just can't walk around acting and misbehaving. And my dad always did say to me, and my mother, live your life as though it's going to be in a newspaper the following day.
Oh, wow.
Now, when I was a kid, before all of this happened, I can tell you that many people who know me, I went to the law school here in Barbados, that I was a kind of a crazy guy. You know, I started driving when I was 11 years old, up and down these streets of Barbados. And I finally figured out why I didn't get caught. Because everyone recognized the license plate as my dad's plate, so they weren't going to stop the car because they thought it was him.
Wow. What was it like being the son of the Prime Minister of Barbados?
Even to this day, you don't get addressed as yourself. You get addressed as, oh, this is Sir Lloyd's son. So it's always like you're this other person that comes behind him. I was at a function a couple of weeks ago. There's a building named after him, the LES Center. And I was there for a function and sat with the Prime Minister, and she introduced me. Oh, this is Garth, whose father's name bears this building. It's like, so I'm always overshadowed by him. And I think that was one of the reasons why I never really wanted to be here, because it was always no opportunity for me to be myself. When I was in New Jersey, I could always be myself.
So what would you mean overshadowed?
All the introductions are going to be Sir Lloyd, my father, and then me.
Right.
And it's not the other way around. Oh, this is Garth and his father. You know, it's always Sir Lloyd and then Garth. And then he has some big shoes, man. My father left some really big shoes to fill, and he was a giant of a man. You know, in my opinion, I think he was probably one of the better prime ministers that the island had. I'm not saying that we don't have good leadership now, but back in that day, he stood for something. Wow. And he stood for what he believed, and he paid dearly for it in terms of losing his seat, but he stood for it. And it turned out that years later that he was right. I think there was a pay cut that needed to be placed at the civil servants, and no one's happy when you got to take money away from them, but it needed to happen so the dollar wouldn't be devalued,
right.
And he made a decision based on that, and so there was this no confidence vote, which I don't ever really fully understand. There are scholars here that can tell you a lot about it. I just know that it was a difficult time for him, and I think there was 2 times in my father's life that were difficult times. That was one of them. And the second one was when my younger sister passed away.
Okay.
Those were very difficult moments for him. So being the son of a former prime minister, it probably matters more here in Barbados than it does overseas. Like, overseas, I'm just a regular guy doing everything. There are many people that love my dad. So I would meet someone and they would always say, oh, your father taught me at school, or he was a wonderful person. I really loved your dad. I admire him. Or they'll tell me a story, or they'll tell me about something that he did for them or their family or something along those lines. I always felt like I was always walking in his shadow.
What did that make you feel like then? Because it sounds like there's some challenges there that you had to deal with.
How did that make me feel? I actually never really thought about that. You know, at first there was this need to want to prove to him that I could be outstanding. And I realized that that was futile. That was exhausting. And so I really wasn't living my life the way I wanted to live it. And then there's this expectation, you know, he was highly educated. He was an island scholar. You know, he went to university. You know, he was a teacher. He was just a really smart man. I mean, if you come to our home and look in our library, it's wall to wall, all the way around books. And that was just one room. And he was smart. So he knew a lot. If I had to say, he was probably one of the smartest people I ever met in my life. He knew a lot of things, and he was a very quiet person, whereas I'm kind of the opposite. I tend to talk a lot. I'm more outgoing, where he would sit, and if he came in, he would listen to you for hours, and then when he spoke, you would listen to him, and he would say his words were very carefully chosen. Right. And that's a skill. That's a skill. People, I don't know. It's you know, when people see you and they see you as a child of a prime minister or a prominent person on the island, I don't know, people just seems like, they, to me, it seems like they have a different expectation. You don't really know if they're talking to you because they want to talk to you or they're talking to you because of who you are. And so sometimes you can't really tell if someone's really authentic or not. And that can be a challenge. When he was in office, everybody wanted to talk to him. Probably like our current prime minister, everyone wants to talk to her. And so are they having a conversation with you because they generally want to have a conversation, or is it using it to get somewhere? At least that's how it came across to me.
I've heard that children of superstars or prime ministers or people who have achieved a lot in their life, they have, could be some type of imposter syndrome, it could be some type of angst around, you know, who they are, because they really are identified as the person who is the famous, the important one. So it's like you just don't seem to be able to get out of that shadow in any shape or form.
Yeah, I mean, my dad asked me if I wanted to become a politician, if I wanted to come in politics and take his place when it was time, and I flat out said no.
Right.
I think he asked, there was three of us, and I have two other sisters. One is still here, and the other one's passed away. I think we all said, no, politics can come across as a very mean, dirty, nasty thing. Even when you're trying to do the right thing, it's you have to have thick skin. Right. But, you know, in terms of dealing with it in a way, I don't know that there are many children of politicians, famous politicians, that I even followed in that suit. They probably went off to do things because you're under scrutiny all the time. And everything you do is can be criticized, right, even if it's not your fault or it has nothing to do with you.
So what does that criticism mean to you then?
Well, it means that a lot of times people don't have all the information. And so you're being judged on something that someone may not have the information about it. People come to our home, and we have a decent home, and they think that, you know, we are super wealthy. And we are in some ways in terms of knowledge and that sort of thing. But people make assumptions that because you are in a particular station that you have no challenges, that you have everything is working in for you, you got it made, you can do whatever you want. That's a big one. People think you can do whatever you want. Or if you know, like, oh, if you need something, you just got to go call somebody and they're going to just give it to you because you are so-and-so's son. That's bullshit. You know, whatever I've gotten or done in my life, I've earned it. I've earned it. And so people feel that way. And it may be true for some, but it wasn't true for me. And it wasn't true for any of my sisters. There was no secondary or gain or anything from our dad being in the position that we had to earn it just like everyone else. But the perception in the public may not have been that, but that's not the case. Everything that I've done in my life, I've done on my own. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've ever asked my father for anything.
What would you say were the three biggest lessons that you learned from your father?
My dad had a saying. The one that comes to me first is, sow a good seed, and in due time, one will reap a just reward. And what does that mean to me? That applies right now to the Daily Gratitude Movement. I've been working on it now for over 4 years. I've been doing personal gratitude for myself, and things are starting to happen. But to me, he always felt like you're not going to get what you want overnight. It's going to take time, but you got to sow a good seed. You got to do the good deed. You got to do the work. You got to put the time in, and you have to cultivate and nurture whatever it is that you're up to. And then in time, you will reap the reward. It's like going to the gym. You don't go to the gym for 6 months and then all of a sudden you're like ripped and looking fit. Man, it takes probably a year or more to really get there. And it's discipline. So that's the other part, is discipline. And I think for me, that was one of the things I would say that I've always followed from my dad, that I knew that if there was anything that I wanted to achieve, I was going to have to put the time in. My dad didn't cut me any slack, right? He didn't cut me any slack. I was more of a mama's boy. But she didn't even cut me any slack either, other unless it was food related. I remember one time my dad said, well, you're your own man. You're going to do it your way anyway. And I said, absolutely, Dad. He knew he wasn't going to tell me what to do, because I would either do the opposite because I was rebellious in the early days, but he knew that I was going to live my life. As a matter of fact, when my sister died 11 years ago and I planned a funeral, and we had the funeral, two funerals. We had one in New Jersey and then we had one here. And he said, you're the captain of your ship. Wherever you decide to set your sail, that's where you're going to go. And that was something he said to me that I remember. You're responsible for your life. You can live the life that you want. And I don't think he ever told me how to live my life. He just wanted me to live my life. Right. I really did get that. In the final years of his life, I spent it with him, which was, I had been gone for 43 years, and I got to spend, last year he passed away, but I've been here in Barbados now almost 4 years, but 3.5 years of his life. And at the time when I came back, I had been gone 43 years. So now we're talking 46 and a half years. And I got to see him from a different perspective. He's the only person I've ever met so far, because I'm still a young guy, that has said, I've done everything that I wanted to do in my life. I've achieved everything that I wanted, that I set out to achieve. I am just here on board time now. And he truly felt that he had accomplished everything that he wanted to accomplish. He's traveled the world numerous times, and to come from a poor family. My grandmother was a shopkeeper here in Lower Carlton. My grandfather was a laborer, cut sugarcane, and they were not wealthy. I found out the other day that there were some families, when my father got accepted into Harsons College, that contributed money to pay for his school fees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just found that out like 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the community. And I don't know if you see that in the community anymore now, right, where families are helping other families because someone stands out, someone has the ability. And that was one of the things I talked about in his eulogy, is that if you see, and my father believed strongly in this, that you see someone that has ability, help them to cultivate that ability, help to pour into them to help them to become great. I think sometimes we're so caught up in ourselves that we only want to achieve for ourselves, and we don't realize that if you can help someone else, that very person might come back and help you down the road, or they might help someone that's connected to you, because I've heard a lot of stories like that.
Right.
That was number one. Number two, he said that to serve one's country was the greatest honor. And I can tell you that he was proud of the fact that he was able to serve his country. Being a civil servant was the highest honor that you could ever have, to help make your country great. I remember back in the day, Barbados was considered a developing country. If you look around Barbados, we've got technology and things that most other islands don't have it the way we do. As a matter of fact, I heard the other day that a lot of people come from other islands to come to our hospital.
Right.
So, I'm here. We have like internet service, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty darn good.
Very good.
Right? Our phone systems. I mean, we have the occasional electrical things, but not anything like it used to be when I was a kid,
right,
where it was going out every week. So it's a very stable place. It's a stable country. It's a stable government. It's just very stable.
And you your third point?
Oh, my third point. And then the other one is the fault finder will find fault in paradise. Right. I love that one because in some kind of way I have adopted that. I've taken it to a whole nother level. I recently made a decision to become consciously aware of any time that I'm complaining and not complain anymore. And that also has to do with gratitude. But he said, you know, fault finder will find fault in paradise. And if you're going looking for something wrong, you're going to find something wrong. So that was the other thing that he shared with me that I also enjoy very much.
You mentioned just in passing conversation that your mother has dementia.
Mm-hmm.
What impact is that? And also the death of your sister. Before we touch on your mother, what was the impact of the death of your sister on the family?
Well, I think to date, I think it's my sister's sudden death is the hardest thing that my family has ever dealt with. It impacted both my parents. I don't think any of them have recovered from it. She was 49 years old when she suddenly had a heart attack and passed away. When I had to call them and tell them that was so, it was the hardest phone call I've ever had to make in my entire life. I actually didn't want to do it. I was trying to get someone else to do it. And they told me, no, I can't do that. I asked my Aunt Vanita to make the phone call for me. She said no. But it was shocking. And I went into a depression as a result of that. As a matter of fact, I hit a downward spiral for probably about a good 5 years where I just felt sad. Because my sister, I didn't know it at the time, my sister represented a safety net for me. I knew I could be crazy and I could go out and do outrageous things, and I'm not talking about jumping off cliffs and stuff like that, but I could take chances, and that if I lost all my money, at least I could call my sister up and say, hey, I need a couch to sleep on, and she'll be like, come on over, you got it, right? Which is something that had happened when I got separated. I said to my sister, I'm moving out of the house. She's like, come on down. You can have that room. So when in life, you have these moments where you've been sheltered most of your life by your parents. They've provided everything that they can for you and not given you an opportunity to really bang your head up against a wall because they put a cushion there when you were about to bang your head. And my sister was the cushion. So was my mother. I knew if I ever had a challenge, I could call my mother and she would do what needed to be done.
Right.
So was my sister, both of my sisters actually, but this one in particular, we were only 11 months apart. Right. And I actually talk about this experience in my book, Gratitude Transform, what it was like that night, getting the phone call from the hospital and saying to come. And I thought she had just been in an accident or something and that she was going to be either hooked up to tubes or something like that, to get there to find out that she had passed while she was at the dentist's office. She collapsed outside and tried to make it back and couldn't and died right there outside the dentist's office. We were like 3 minutes away from home. Wow. And that was really shocking to me because I had imagined a life that her and I would get old together. We were very close. We lived in the same town. Wherever she was, I was. Wherever I was, she was. Right. And so that was difficult. And it was difficult for my other sister and it was difficult for my mother and father. It was to have your child die before you is an experience that you really can't explain. My ex-wife and I, we had a daughter that had died also. Right. But she didn't have many years on this earth. She had maybe an hour and a half on this earth. And that was challenging for my ex, but not so challenging for me. But to have a child who's been around 49 years and all of a sudden they're not here anymore, that was difficult. It was difficult for the entire family. My aunt, my mother's sister, it was even more difficult for her because they were close, and she's no longer with us anymore. She's passed away as well, too. But, yeah, it was a challenging time for the whole entire family. I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but unfortunately, we don't know, you know, when it's time to move on. As they say, you know, your car's been punched and it's time to go. We don't know what's going to happen or the circumstances. And I can tell you the difference between when she died and when my father died and in between, there were some very close friends who also passed away. The difference in how I dealt with everything was gratitude. Right. I didn't have gratitude back then. Had I had gratitude back then when my sister passed away, I don't think I would have had some of the challenges. I used to smoke. By the time I stopped smoking cigarettes, I was smoking like 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Right.
And actually, the night she died, I had stopped smoking. And the night she died, I started smoking again. And everything just got progressively worse. I started smoking. I started drinking. I can't say I started eating a lot, but I just was, didn't want to feel anything. I didn't want to feel the sadness I felt. I even go back to the, you know, when I came back from her funeral, which was in, she died in July, July 25th. Funeral was in August. There was a entertainment center that was in her house. And I got so angry, I went and got a circle saw, dragged it outside, and I cut it up into little pieces and put it in a pile just to get the frustration out, the anger, the sadness, the pain. And I remember my mom and dad came back because we had some estate stuff to take care of. And my mother was like, where's the entertainment center? I said, it's outside. And my mother, being who she is, she actually went outside looking for it. And I had it covered over a tarp. And she's like, oh, this is interesting. Oh, what happened here? I said, oh, no, don't worry about it. But it was funny.
Going into where you are now with your mother, what's the impact on your life right now?
I got a phone call. My sister came here on a holiday from the Netherlands, and the doctors had noticed that there was something going on, and she came and she observed that my mother really needed some help. And because of my circumstances, I was the single, divorced. My kids are all adults. And I was the closest one. She's like, you really need to come take on this responsibility. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm finally, you know, I'm a realtor, and I'm finally getting on a roll with selling houses. And, you know, I had flipped some properties as a wholesaler. My whole world was real estate. And all of a sudden, I had to give all of that up. I gave it all up. I gave up my house. I gave up my car. I gave up my career. And I got on a plane, and I came back because I knew it was the right thing to do. And I left everything behind. I think I just came with four suitcases. And for me, I didn't know what to expect, because it's difficult to see two amazing human beings. My mother's is a doctor. She's got a PhD from Columbia University, Ivy League school in New York, and my dad was who he was. And to now be the person that has to take care of them, to tell them what they need to do, to be there to hold their hand, because I held my dad's hand a lot of times, and my mother, she saw comfort in me, and to see that now I have to be the decision maker for them, that's not a role that I ever wanted. Not even right now, to this day, that I ever wanted. But it's the role that I had to embrace. And I never thought in my life that I would have to give everything up. But there is a good that has come out of all of this. I've lost before, but not like where you just have to give everything. I mean, I didn't lose it. I just had to give it up. Mm-hmm. I had to walk away from it. And the beautiful thing about it is I've been blessed. I didn't know a blessing was coming from that, because I just came, and then I got here, and then what, 2-3 months later, we got COVID, we were in a lockdown, and that was a whole different experience. But I
think everyone will say the same thing.
Yeah.
3 years of trauma that no one really understands.
Yeah, really. It was just, but it worked in my favor.
Right.
It worked in my favor. I started the gratitude movement during COVID. Mm-hmm. And even before I came, I had a challenge earlier that year in 2019 where I ran out of money. I had no more cash, man. I ran out of cash. All my savings, everything, I ran out of money. All I had was my house. The house was paid for, but I ran out of cash. And that summer, when the winter was over, my electricity got shut off. First time ever it ever happened. I mean, I could see it happening because I didn't pay the bill, or I just coming up short, but I owed thousands of dollars. Right. And I just didn't have it. And so they came and they shut it off. And I lived in my house for 100 days without electricity.
100 days?
100 days.
Wow.
In those 100 days was probably some of the best days of my lifetime. So that's why the book is called From Darkness to Light.
What makes 100 days of darkness the best days of your lifetime?
Because I found out that my joy isn't attached to anything outside of me. I found out that I can be happy no matter what's going on in my life, no matter what kind of crap's happening, I could be happy no matter what. I had one of the best summers ever. And I also lost another friend in a motorcycle accident, died in the Garden State Parkway instantly that one weekend around July 4th. And I was able to navigate that. And I was able to navigate a whole bunch of other things. And I experienced kindness in a way that I never thought. Because one of my friends, after, like, on day 99, I got a phone call the next day. We were talking, and then I got a phone call the next day. And, like, I couldn't sleep a wink last night, man, knowing that you haven't had electricity for, like, such a long time. How much do you owe? I said, I owe $3,000 and change. They're like, what's your bank account number? I'm going to wire the money to you. And this is not a loan. This is a gift. Just get it turned on and go do your thing. And I had started practicing gratitude that year. And I believe that because I started practicing gratitude and I started to not focus on what was wrong, that I started to become happy and that I attracted this person. Because I did a Facebook Live for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I finished on that 99th day, I finished my 30 days of Facebook Lives. And then that was the night I got the call. And then the next day was when I got the blessing, the gift. And I remember coming back home and standing in my kitchen and looking at the lights on, and the AC was running. And I said to myself, I don't think there will ever be a time in my life where I'll ever be ungrateful about anything. And that was the greatest gift that I ever got in my life. So that hardship, or at least what appeared to be a hardship, was actually a blessing. I had never really dealt with any kind of hardship. I was broke before, and I just got through it. I kind of work. You know, you just navigate. You just don't eat as much, right? You just don't do a whole lot of things. But this time it was different. I actually got to feel the pain, the embarrassment, and all the stuff that went along with it. And I realized that I actually set myself free in that period where I just was so concerned about what other people thought. And then all of a sudden, one day, it's like, well, the thing that you were most afraid of actually happens. And no one actually even said anything. No one even really cared. Right. You know, I mean, I did share it with one or two people, and they were like, okay, well, you know, you'll get it back, you know.
Yeah.
But this particular person was like, no, I can't, because you're always doing stuff for everybody. You're always out there doing stuff. And she said, you know, I got to do this for you.
Why did this gratitude movement come about? Is that simply because the electricity was off, or... what was the creation of this?
I started practicing gratitude when electricity got shut off, a week after.
What do you mean practicing gratitude?
There was this group that I ran. It was a meetup. It was called the New Jersey Power Team. Mm-hmm. And every month I would have a speaker come in, and so I kept my commitments. And the guy that gave me the challenge, his name is Tony, and Tony was a speaker that night. And at the end of the talk, we were standing around as we were closing up and getting ready to shut the place up. Started talking about gratitude. And he said, you know, you should try it. As a matter of fact, for 30 days, why don't you send me three things that you're grateful for?
For 30 days?
For 30 days, every day.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting? Next May 17th, which is next Friday, mm-hmm. will be 5 years that I've been sending him a text every day.
So what type of things would you be sending him?
Lately, is the one thing I always start my gratitude is I'm grateful that I woke up today and I got to see another day. I have an opportunity to work on something that I started yesterday. I get another day of life. I'm grateful for divine guidance and divine intelligence and divine protection. I'm grateful for challenges that show up in my life. I'm grateful for opportunities to work on myself. I'm grateful for my mother. I'm grateful for my children. I'm grateful for transportation. I'm grateful that I got to go to the gym and work out. I'm grateful that I got a book coming out. I'm grateful for air conditioning, whatever. I'm grateful that I can pee. Mm. I'm grateful I can see, that I can chew. You know, I'm grateful for the friendships that I have. I'm grateful for the team that has developed around this here. Basically, and the challenge from Tony was to send him at least one unique thing every day. And I think I've managed to do that. In almost 5 years, sent him at least one unique thing. I've saved all the gratitude texts that I've sent to Tony. It's probably close to 50, 60,000 things that I've sent him.
Wow. And so focusing your mind in that way, what does it actually do for you?
Well, you know, when you are focused on the good in life, you have a higher level of access to a higher intelligence, to thought. Because the opposite of that, just being angry and ungrateful, you're tapping into a negative resource. And through gratitude, you get to be happier. You get to be a happier person because you're focusing on what's good. And so I've reframed a lot of things to say, and when there's a challenge, I used to use the word problems. I don't use the word problem. I just use challenge. So the challenge has come up, and I say this is an opportunity. And so every challenge that I come across is an opportunity for me to learn something that I didn't know before, to do something that I didn't know, or to step out of my comfort zone, to push through in a way that is going to empower someone else. So for me, gratitude, and I had a friend of mine, Roshanak, at the time, I remember her asking me, do you know what are the benefits of gratitude? I said, listen, I don't know. I just know I'm a happier person. She said to me, well, I think you should Google it, so you should find out. So gratitude impacts like your finances, your love life, your health, your relationships, your mind. It impacts practically every area of your life.
I mean, I remember years ago, I did Tony Robbins.
Unleash the Power Within.
Unleash the Power Within, and we did the firewalk. But I remember one of the things that he said during that seminar, and he said, I'm grateful every single day. And strangely enough, you're a Tony Robbins coach as well. So how does being around someone like that, what's the impact on your life being in the presence of someone like Tony Robbins, who I think is a phenomenal what he's done?
Well, you know, you got to go back to when I went to the Tony Robbins event, I was at that crossroad in life. You know, I was in my 40s, and I knew that the career I was in at the time, it was a systems analyst, technology, and I was a level 3 tech support. So I was on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And even though I was good at what I did, I didn't like it. I knew that there was some other calling on my life. But I was struggling with this whole identity thing, right? Like, who am I and what is it that I'm truly supposed to be doing? Because what I was doing at the time wasn't really working for me. So I made a decision that I had gotten separated a year before, and I always wanted to go to Tony. So I decided this year is my year. I'm going to Tony Robbins. This is 2004. This year will be 20 years. I went there with the intention of playing full out because it was my last stop, because I didn't know what else to do. So I was hopeless when I got there. And there was a lot of things I wanted to change about my life. As a matter of fact, I wanted to change everything about my life. Okay. I didn't want to be married anymore. I didn't want to be at the job I was at anymore. I didn't want to be in the career I was in anymore. That was the year that I became a certified empowerment coach. It was a one year program that I took that. It took many years before I became a Tony Robbins trainer. I started out as a participant. And then after I became a participant, I became crew. And then I went through his leadership mastery program and did that and became a senior leader. And then from senior leaders, you have to demonstrate your ability. And if you meet their criteria and your level of expertise is good, then they will give you an invite you to become a trainer. It's not something you can apply for. So I've been to probably close to 100 Tony Robbins events. Not quite yet, but it's pretty close, maybe about... maybe 80,
right, okay.
You know, over the 20 years. And one of the things I like about the Tony Robbins environment, we don't always get to see Tony other than when he's on stage, because he's large now and he's got security, and you don't really get to see him, you know, unless he's on stage and he's in a state. But what I like about the environment is, and Tony's philosophy is that he always goes after the best of the best when it comes to whatever skill it is that he might be looking at. So if it's finances, he's going to go talk to all the best finance people, and he has conversations. He's got a program called Business Mastery that I did. You know, he would invite CEOs as a keynote speaker, and you would get to hear the mindset. And one of the things that I can tell you that's been consistent, and I've heard a lot of CEOs speak, is being able to deal with no. And these guys, like, they got like 200 no's, 300 no's before they actually got what they wanted. You know how persistent you have to be? Wow. Some people get one no or two no's, and they're like, oh, my God, my life's over because I got two no's. I got shut down, right? And so that was something that I learned. And then there's other programs that he has But I remember that second year. So I did the UPW, did the firewalk. When I did the firewalk, it blew my mind because it was something I didn't think I could do. Right. And when I did it, I was like, holy crap, man. What else can I do in my life? Or what else is holding me back that I need to break through? So that was transformational for me. And I was fortunate at that first event to be picked by Tony every single day for the 3 days that he did it. And the final day we had an interaction. To me, it felt like it lasted 5 to 10 minutes, but it probably only lasted only about 2 minutes or so, maybe three. And he had talked about being this young guy. He had lost everything. And he was living in this 800 square foot apartment in California, washing his dishes in his bathtub and feeling less than, feeling not good enough because he didn't have a college degree and he didn't have all these things. And he was just broken. He had put on like 30 pounds. And he, when he was telling the story, I just remember going into a trance and saying, dude, you feel like you're talking to me and you're talking about me. Because at that point, in 2004, I was now a year separated. So I was searching for my soul. So he picked me, asked me where I was from. I told him where I was from. He asked me what was holding me back in life. And I said what most people say when they get picked by Tony is, I'm not good enough. And he said to me, that was a bunch of bullshit. I've been watching you all weekend and I could tell that you're a good person. What is it that you really want? And back then, my marriage didn't work out. I was the one that actually ended it. After a year by myself, I really wanted a relationship. I wanted a partner. And he asked me, well, what kind of partner do you want? I said, well, I didn't even really know, but that means something. And I'll come to that in a second. But I said something, I don't even remember what I said, but I just said, what kind of relationship do you want? He said, with a man or a woman? I said, no, a woman. And I also didn't realize what he was doing when he did it, but now I do it all the time. It's called a pattern interrupt. And he said, well, I want you to go out into the crowd and I want you to pick a woman. I never knew that my hands could shake so much. I didn't know my knees could actually touch each other while I was walking. And I didn't know that I could sweat so much because I was sweating and shaking at the same time. And I was walking around the auditorium. There was about 2,500, 3,000 people there. And I'm thinking, well, damn, I don't really know what I want. And so people were yelling at me, pick her, pick her, pick her. And I was looking at all these different women and I'm thinking to myself, why, you know, I couldn't pick one. But I had this thing, which is you don't know about it until later on when you do the next program, which is called a primary question. Mm-hmm. And my primary question was, how could I not look stupid? And so I wasn't going to go on stage. I was not going to be on stage up there with him, elevated now, so everyone could see me, because my mindset was, I'm not going to do anything that's ever going to make me look stupid. Mm-hmm. Now I'm totally opposite. And so I got scared, and I picked the mic runner. Because I just didn't want to go up there. I just picked someone I didn't even like or even know.
Right.
Although I found out later when I was in Denver who she was because I saw her there. And I realized that if you don't know what it is that you want, anything will do. And you're living your life by default. Right. And that's really not a good way to live your life. You need to be deliberate and intentional.
Just say that again. That was quite deep, the way what you just said.
Well, if you don't know what you want, you're going to be living your life by default. Right. And that's not a way to live your life, because whatever happens in the universe or around you is what happens to you too. Right. You can create your life in an intentional way and design it however you want. Most people don't consciously think that they have that ability to do that. I did not know at the time that that was what I was doing. It took me about another year and a half to figure out what I just said to you. Right. So back to the auditorium here. So I picked this lady. The room in Tony Robbins style, the lights come on, the music come on, people are jumping up and down and clapping, and Tony's crying and stuff, and I'm thinking, like, what the hell is going on here? All right, and then he says to me, and all of a sudden he does this thing, and his hand across his neck to cut the music, and it's like you could hear a fart in the room. It was so quiet. And he looks at me, and he says, she doesn't think you're good enough, and she doesn't want to be with you. What are you going to do? My brain shut down. I lost all consciousness. I couldn't think. I didn't have there was no part of me that could move. I was like frozen in that spot. And the only thing that happened was my mouth opened up and I said the word next, N-E-X-T. And I thought to myself once it came out, like, where the hell did that come from? But our subconscious mind sometimes has the answers that we need if we can access our subconscious mind. And when I said next, he cried again. And then this time the entire room went ballistic and the music was on probably for at least a good like 30 seconds to, you know, to a minute. And all of a sudden, there were all these men coming up to me saying, dude, what you just said is exactly how I feel every day. And that's how I'm feeling right now. And I'm so proud of you because you said that. Because there's men that are afraid to talk to women because they're going to get beat down or they feel rejected or they just have been emasculated. Some crap or something has happened in their life that's really messed with them. And I, for the first time, I realized I wasn't alone. There was like other people. I thought I was by myself. I thought I was the only one dealing with shit. Right. And then even women came up to me and said, hey, I know somebody would be great for you. And here's my card. I mean, women were coming up. And I mean, I became instantly like a little celebrity for, you know, while I was at the rest of the remainder of the event. And I just remembered to myself, like all of a sudden overnight, I had this insatiable confidence. And after that event was over, because it was a 4-day event, and I would think it would end on a Sunday or a Monday back in the day. And that following week was Thanksgiving. And there was this British girl that was at my aunt's house. And I loved her accent. And I said, I'm going to date this woman. And I don't give a shit what she says. I'm going to ask her out. I was at my godparents' house and I was giving her a tour of the house. It was because they had a nice house. And I said, when I get up to the top of the stairs, I'm going to ask her out. And we got up to the stairs, and I said, no, I would love to take you out. This is Thursday. I said, are you free on Friday? She said, no. I said, okay. Are you free on Saturday? She said, no. I said, are you free on Sunday? She said, no. I said, I was about to say, are you free on Monday? And she said, wait. How about if you come pick me up and you come to church with me on Sunday, then I'll have a date with you after church. Wow. I said, where do you live and what time you want me to pick you up? And we dated for probably 11 months. Mm-hmm. I realized that we weren't really a great match. And so that didn't work out in that sense. But she was a wonderful, wonderful lady. That's when I started to realize that if you don't know what you want, anything will do. Right. And when I had a chance to go to Denver, Colorado, and I met the lady that I picked at the event, her name was Julie. And we talked about it. And she says, you know, we're microrunners. We're not supposed to get involved with the participants. Or we're not, you know, we're supposed to be invisible.
Right.
You know, you were supposed to pick like another participant. And I said, well, it didn't happen that way. Right. And then I signed up for Tony Robbins' leadership program. And it was at Leadership Academy. It was called something else back then. I think it was called Leadership Boot Camp or something like that. There was the guy at the time, CEO of Tony Robbins' company, came and he spoke. And he talked about living your life with intention or living it by default. And that's when I understood that what I had done, because I didn't know what I wanted.
You're living by default.
All right. I just picked the first person that showed up, mm-hmm. thinking that that's the one. Mm-hmm. And that's not, you can't live your life the way. But people don't know that they have a choice. They really don't. A lot has happened since then. And I'll say this one thing here, because it looks like you have another question. The identity that you have for yourself is what your life is going to be like. Your identity determines who you are and what you do. And if your identity sucks, you're going to suck. I mean, I don't know of any other way to put it, but if you don't feel like you can be something, you're not. And so you've got to do the work. You've got to be coachable, be open-minded, and really get clarity on what it is. Because there was this guy named Larry Ackerman that wrote the book called The Identity Code. And he said, when you know who you are, you'll know what to do. And I believe that with all my heart to this day.
So what does it mean people are walking around and they don't know, they don't have a clear identity? So that means they're living a life that's not right for them.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to tell people how to live their life, but I meet a lot of people and they say, man, if money were no object, I would be doing something else. Right. So you clearly, you've at a job that you're doing, well, I just need to make money. And I get that you need to make money. We all need to make money. But you can make money doing anything. I was born in the 60s. Where there were only certain jobs, right? You could become an engineer, a doctor, or a lawyer, or something, a professional person, and you were considered an engineer. That was the other one.
Right.
And if you had any of those things, you were guaranteed, you know, you were guaranteed to have a decent life. At least you would have the money to do it. But now I see so many people that are artistic, so many people doing what they love and making a tremendous living out of it. Look at actors. Actors, they make a killing. Mm. Look at athletes. They love to play sports, and they play sports and make a boatload of money. So you can do what you love and make money. You may not make as much as some, but you could, you know, if you are enjoying yourself, chances are you're going to produce a better quality product. You're going to have more fun doing it, and you probably may even live longer because you're having fun in your life and you look forward to your days. You know, you call it the rat race, the grind.
So you're saying really find a thing that you love and make that your priority in your life?
Yeah, I think so. I think that you can. Now, you might have to do some a side hustle or something while you build it, right? But if you truly believe that you can, and there's enough evidence now, I think, with the internet and all the things you see on social media, there's enough evidence to show that the people who are creative are rewarded, and they're rewarded justly. Right. And that goes back to sow a good seed.
Absolutely. But referencing back to your father.
Yeah, yeah. Look,
one thing that you mentioned, which might take us back a little bit, but you mentioned you're not good enough.
So
was that in all aspects of your life, or is that just particular areas?
So this is in the past, right? So there was a point in my life where I didn't think I was good enough for anything. Right. I didn't get a lot of reinforcement from the people that really mattered, you know, like my parents. And it's not that they didn't know that they should be doing it. It was just that they were operating based on how their life was. Right. If you believe that you got to go work for someone and you've got to have a certain kind of job and you've got to make this kind of money, then you're operating in that default space. Right. And if in my heart, I knew that there was something else that I wanted to do. And even when I started doing it, because I remember I retired from my job in 2006. Mm-hmm. And when I retired, it was a result of going to Date with Destiny and realizing that I can no longer live this other life. Now, retiring from my job, it meant that I would have some financial hardships. I had started a company with three other people, and I was the first one to leave and go out. And when I did that, a recession hit. They bailed, and so I couldn't go back to the job. And so I experienced a tremendous financial hardship. That was really my first time ever really experiencing financial hardship. But I didn't go back to corporate. I didn't ever want to go back to corporate. I would have rather eaten sardines out of a can than go back into the corporate world just to do something just for the sake of a dollar bill, because I knew there was something else. Now, I'm not saying I don't know what it is for other people. I just knew for me that there was something else that I needed to do with my life. And so I stuck it out, and it was hard. You know, I lost a lot. I lost a lot of stuff. I lost most of my possessions back then. But I felt free, and that freedom, I didn't want to give it up for no reason. So going back, when I made the decision to retire from my job, I had to hire a coach, and it took a year to make that decision. I had to get coached every week. How am I going to transition this? And the transition went as planned, but there were all these unexpected things that happened. I'd never been an entrepreneur before. I'd never been in business before. I didn't know that, you know, maybe when you have a partnership that you needed to have agreements with your partner. So if they bail on you, there's some accountability. So I got stuck holding the ball, and I stuck it out. I stuck it out, and it was difficult. It was hard. And going back to the decision to leave, I remember when I made the announcement to my employer that I was going to retire. I remember my boss at the time, he said, "Man, what took you so long?" They were expecting it from me because of the trajectory that I was on.
Right.
And then there were other people that were like, "Dude, why would you leave such a good paying job? Why would you give this up to go do something else? Why? You're crazy. It doesn't make any sense." Mm. I was told I was crazy. Mm-hmm. I was told I was stupid. I was told a lot of not nice things.
Right.
That even just made me even more determined. And then I remember the day I retired, I didn't even tell my parents, I didn't tell my sister, I didn't tell any of my immediate family. I mentioned it to my ex-wife, and she made sure the divorce went through before I got out. And my ex-wife and I, we're very tight now, and that took work. I mean, we can talk about forgiveness, but I remember going over to my sister when it passed to when I told her that I retired, And she said, "You did what?" And she was like, "Get out of my house." She was so pissed. And I said, "That's why I didn't tell you."
Right.
Because I knew you would respond that way. Mm-hmm. Because I think the default for people is safety, not risk. Right. The default for people is comfort, not challenge. You know, the default for people is, let's go with the status quo. Right. The default is, I don't want any problems in my life, so I'm going to take the safe route. Right. That's the default. I don't want that no more for myself. I don't regret it, not one day. I would do it all over again the same exact way, with maybe one exception that I would have done better financial planning.
Right.
I got the confidence to do that from attending Tony Robbins events and being in that community. I love that community so much because there's always this feel to be at a higher standard in life. Like there's no low standard that they don't accept low standards. It's always high standards. Tony has high standards. Right. And I had done some other thing that, you know, we were talking about before. I'd also done Landmark Education. I became an introduction leader. I did the ILP program, as they call it. Mm-hmm. It was the hardest thing I ever did in my life was that introduction leaders program. It was 6 months. They felt like they gutted me like a fish. You know, by the end of that program, I was like, damn, I would never do this again.
Right.
But I grew so much, and I actually made it to the end. I think like 75% of the people don't ever make it in that program, but I was one of the people that made it. I was one of the three or four people that made it in that program. In the time frame, and I had to bust my ass to get through that because I slacked up, and then I had to go in for 4 weeks. I went in every single day from 8 in the morning till 9 at night to make up what I had missed.
Oh, wow.
And it taught me something. I got a gift from that, and it's actually helped me in the now to be able to achieve that. And I saw people showing up for me. So when you go back to talking about not feeling good enough, it was the people that I surrounded myself to help me to see that version of myself that was good enough. And when I retired, I had written a short story. Yeah, in 2005, I had written a short story for my mother for Mother's Day, which is coming up, you know, this Sunday, called My Mother's Mango Tree. Mm-hmm. I read that at a Life Mastery in California, and people were in tears. And
is it long, or is it something that you can't read out because you're going to read it on Mother's Day?
Well, I read it already. This is going back in 2005.
Oh, right. Okay.
So that was the first book that I published. It was a children's book, mm-hmm, called My Mother's Mango Tree.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read it, the entire room, there was about 100 people in the room, they're like, dude, you need to publish that. You need to make that into a book. And I'm thinking to myself, look, it's a page and a half. It's a short story. Mm-hmm. Well, make it a children's book. Right. It took me 10 years to do that.
Oh, wow.
And I finally did it because every time I would see the lady, Lauren, she would ask me, did you do it yet? Did you do it yet? And I got tired of her asking me. And I'm like, I'm going to just get it done. And going back to 2005, when I, you know, shared it publicly at a New York Power Team meeting, I saw people's reaction. I had retired from my job and I was questioning whether I had made the right decision. And when I stood in that room and I watched Nava read my story, and I saw almost every person in the room in tears. Oh, wow. I stood there and I said, I made the right decision. I was like, okay, let's keep going, Garf. Let's keep going.
That's incredible, man. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned as well was you've adopted not complaining.
Yes.
So where did that come from?
So what happens is when you practice gratitude for a while, you just get to the point like, why even complain about anything? There's gratitude in every situation, even the bad ones. And I also realized that complaining is darkness. It's darkness. When you complain, the energy that you create is negative energy. It does not solve the challenge that's in front of you. It does not create anything. It just expands what's there. It changes your focus and it puts you in an unresourceful state. I realized that. And I was like, I don't want to be that person anymore. There's too many people around me complaining about stupid stuff. Like, really? You're complaining about that? You're driving down the street and someone's going sped around you. You don't know what their situation is. You don't know if they're trying to get to the hospital to see a loved one before they die or something. You just don't know, right? So why are you getting upset? Someone messes up your day because they didn't do what they were supposed to do, or they didn't show up when they said they were going to show up, and it messed up your day. You're going to complain about that. That's not, it doesn't solve anything. So one day as I was writing my gratitude, I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to complain about anything. And I went public about it. So on my lives, when I talk about that I've made this decision. And when I'm talking to my team members, when I'm talking to my friends, I tell them. And so when I'm talking to them, I catch myself doing it. I say, oh, you know what? I'm complaining again. I don't want to do that. Because when you don't complain, you have access to a higher intelligence. You have access to divine knowledge. You go into a creative space where you start to think, okay, well, there's a problem or a challenge. What is it that I need in order to be able to get through this? And that's where the creation starts to happen. In that room that we talked about, thoughts become things. Mm-hmm. Everything is created twice, once in your mind and then in the physical. And I realized that if I'm thinking problems, I'm going to manifest more problems. Right. So if I'm thinking, what am I grateful for this? What's the gift? What's the blessing? I'm going to manifest gifts and blessings. And so I'm not 100% there, but I'm further along than I ever have been before. It doesn't even feel right anymore.
To complain,
no.
So that leads us neatly into your book, Gratitude Transform from Darkness to Light. How has that come about?
Well, you know, God bless my team, right? Or the board, the fundraising committee. They came to me in the form of a video. I got a video message one day from the fundraising chair, and she said, I've got a challenge for you. We were talking today at the fundraising meeting, and we thought it would be great if you would write a book. And if you accept our challenge, we can use this book at our next fundraising event. And if you accept this challenge, you have 90 days.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, I absolutely love challenges. I'm doing it. And I sent back a video. Yes, I accept your challenge. And I was actually going to write a different book. I have another book that I've been working on for a few years now called The Code, K-O-D-E, which stands for No Opportunity Destroy Excuses.
No opportunity destroy
excuses.
Excuses.
Yeah.
Okay.
I had co-authored it originally years ago with a former business partner. We did the proof copy, but we never published it. I wanted to rewrite it, so I'm rewriting the book. Right. So I was going to do that. And then I decided, no, I don't want to do it. I think all of a sudden divine intelligence stepped in and said, no, you need to write about gratitude. That's how the book got started. So I decided I was going to write about gratitude. The title didn't even come until after I was almost done. Because at first it was going to be about 100 days of, I think it was 100 days of darkness or something like that. I don't remember what the original title was because it's changed so much. Mm. And I started out by telling the story of my sister passing away, accepting the challenge to send Tony daily gratitude texts, and then, you know, the formation of the gratitude movement. The book has evolved it's in two parts, so part one and part two. Part two is my story. Part two is the gratitude movement and the stories of people that are in the gratitude movement and how gratitude has impacted them. Because we've got people from all walks of life. We've got people that are blind, that are cerebral palsy, MS, autoimmune illnesses, and you know, there was one lady who's in the book, her son was murdered and she was angry and she came in to the gratitude movement, as a member, and completely had radical transformation in her life as a result of practicing gratitude. And she says, you know, like the daily gratitude movement is like free therapy. People spend thousands of dollars to go to a therapist, and really all they need to do is come to the daily gratitude room because it's a live room. And share and talk about gratitude and listen to people talk about gratitude, and you won't need therapy.
Wow.
And I've seen that happen over and over again. So she's very accurate about that. So that's how the book came about. And as I started to work on a book, it started to evolve and take on a life of its own. And it's not the same book that I started out with. So now we're looking forward to that coming out, and to the launch is this coming Friday, May 17th, and because of that, the May 17th date is the day I celebrate 5 years of gratitude. Wow. So that's why it's on that day. And the book is designed to support the gratitude movement, to show people how gratitude can change your life, and to follow us and to support us and to even come join us. We have members from the UK. Right. We have a lot of members from the UK, as a matter of fact. It's designed to just be a story to tell people that this is how your life can get better just from the practice of gratitude. And it doesn't have to be anything elaborate. But just waking up every day and finding something to be grateful for changes your physiology.
Yeah, I remember when Tony Robbins again, when he talked about gratitude, he talked about it from a perspective, he gets on his knees and he prays in a way, he's grateful for everything in his life until he gets to tears.
Yeah. You know,
I tried that in my life. I think I've adopted, because we met basically talking about gratitude, some of the pieces that I've written, and you know, what you're doing right now, and there was that synergy, which I thought was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's getting into gratitude, how do you start? What do you do? And how do you not complain about aspects of life?
It's a journey. It's like a staircase, right? You start at the bottom of the stairs. And the more you do it, and the more grounded you become in it, then there's just things that you just don't want to do anymore. When I first started practicing gratitude, I was still complaining. I was grateful for the things that I was grateful for, and I started to feel joy. But as I evolved, I started to realize that these things don't matter. It could also be a combination of that. I also, not only do I practice gratitude, but I'm always reading books. I'm very much into personal development. I started coaching clients again as an empowerment coach. So my mindset has shifted a lot. And then I also firsthand have seen the transformation of hundreds of people in their practice of gratitude. And they become volunteers for the movement. So how do you start? You just start, right? You know, the journey of 1,000 steps starts with the first one, right? Or the journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. Mm-hmm. You just start. You just start by writing down what you're grateful for. But there's a difference, though. It's not just writing gratitude, actually. Writing gratitude, sharing gratitude, and speaking gratitude is a powerful combination. It's like gratitude that's supercharged. Because when you write it, it's just you and
a piece of paper.
Piece of paper and your source.
Right.
When you share it, it's the person, it's not a conversation, you're just sending them, they're reading what you wrote and they are thinking about what you said.
So when you share it, what do you mean you're sharing it? You're sharing your gratitude or you're sharing what you feel about that person?
No, I'm sharing my gratitude with another human being. I'm sending, so my gratitude started out as texts. Mm-hmm. So I'm sending my gratitude to, well, now it's about 50 people. And I didn't know I was even having an impact on their lives until one day I was late.
Right.
See, you don't know something. You don't know something is not working until it doesn't work, right? Or you don't know what's going on until something breaks or something doesn't happen. And I remember getting a phone call from one of my friends. Where's my gratitude text? I had a little glitch. I'm getting out. Listen, dude, I set my watch to your gratitude text every day. I look forward to reading your texts because it helps me to set my day up. And sometimes we do things and we don't even realize that we're impacting someone else's life in a positive way. But the same thing goes the other way, too. We don't realize that we're doing things that impacts people's lives in a positive way as well, too. But my gratitude text was having a positive impact on the lives of the people who are receiving it. And some of these people, not just Tony, I think there's about 5 of them that have been getting my gratitude text ever since I started, for 5 years almost. Right. So that's the sharing of it. They just get it and they read it whenever they read it. And then there's the speaking of your gratitude out, coming into the Daily Gratitude Movement, to our clubhouse room, and saying what you're grateful for in front of 50 people. When you share it, now it becomes part of what these people hear. And to me, it's like the satellite dish, and it sends the signal of gratitude out into the universe. And it amplifies and it comes back to you even tenfold, because now I'm hearing your gratitude and I'm experiencing that along with you. So my energy is now wrapped into your energy and there's an amplification process. Right. And then you share your gratitude, I'm hearing your gratitude, and then you're sharing about something that I might have never thought about. Like there's this one lady, Kimmy, she talks about, I'm grateful for toilets because I'm grateful that I don't have to go dig a hole in the ground. And you don't think about that, right? Or you don't think of someone who was sick in the hospital and someone else needed to take care of them. I remember when I heard it for the first time, this lady was grateful that she could wipe her own ass. Right. And she's like, I could do it. I couldn't do it before. And you take it for granted. And then when you hear that, you're like, you know what, man, I'd be grateful for that too. So you hear things like that, or you hear things like, I'm grateful I didn't get shot today. because the person is coming from a country where there's some kind of war going on. And you put it into that perspective. And then the other thing, too, is gratitude is something that you can feel. You can really feel gratitude. And I know that is true because there were people who come in that didn't speak English. They were either Arabic or French or Spanish or some other language. And we would say to them, listen, you don't have to try to speak English. Just share it in your own language. And they would share their gratitude and you could feel what they were saying. You speak it out, you share it, and you write it.
So is this a form of prayer? What is it? Because you've talked about the universe, you've talked about manifestation. Is there a spiritual leaning to you, or what do you mean? Is it a prayer?
Well, depending on what you believe, gratitude is a form of a prayer. It's whoever you believe in, whatever you believe in. Because you're really saying to whatever supernatural things out there that run this planet, for me it would be God, that I'm grateful. It's almost like you're having gratitude that they created you.
Right.
You're having gratitude that you are even here on this planet. And so you're thanking them, whoever they are, for just being here. And when you are grateful for stuff, man, more of it comes to you. Nobody wants to give money to like a miserable, mean person.
Right.
But they want to give money to someone who's kind and generous. Right? We run from people who are just like energy vampires.
Energy vampires.
Yeah. But when somebody's genuinely kind and nice and they need help, you want to help a genuinely kind and nice person.
And you know what's really quite significant for me is I've been writing a piece, and I'll just read this piece to you.
Okay.
It says, don't keep your attention focused on your problems because you will attract more problems. If you focus on debt, you will get more debt. Focus on fear, you will become more fearful. Focus on what can go wrong and trust and believe it will go wrong. So what you're saying is, focus on the things that you can change. Focus on the great things in your life as opposed to the challenges and problems in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to bring you the abundance that you need to resolve the challenges.
Yeah, 100%. You are a match to whatever energy you're generating in your body, in your mind.
Right.
Now, it takes time.
When you say match.
A match, okay. So you're a vibrational match. So if you are worried all the time, you're generating worried energy. And that's going to just attract, because like attracts like. You're going to attract like energy to yourself that's worrisome. So you're going to end up with people around you all the time that are worrying about stuff, and you're wondering, why is my life sucking? You realize that you've got to change your peer group. It's not to say you can't have one person, but all your peer group can't be all the same. You want people from all different levels. You don't ever want to be the smartest person in the room. You don't want to be the happiest person in the room. You want to have a variety of people around you that they can complement you, and together you rise together like a tide.
But realistically, we've been conditioned from childhood to be a certain way. Lots of people don't know how to get out of that headspace. So how do you actually begin? If you're somebody who you've had a traumatic upbringing, or you've had some issues and stuff that you just can't get out of your head, how would you start this new journey?
Well, my first response is get a coach. If you can't get a coach, make a decision that you want to change it. Even if you don't know how, make a decision. And God, the universe, whatever it is you believe, is going to send resources to you. But make a decision. You know, as the saying goes, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Right.
Just become ready. Even if you don't know how, just become ready. And when you become ready, somebody's going to show up in your life, and all of a sudden you're going to have the right person at the right time.
I totally believe in what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Really get where you're coming from with all of this. What books are you reading right now?
Man, I was listening How to Assert Yourself. That was one of the books I was listening to. And I think yesterday I was, what was I listening to yesterday?
Do you prefer to listen to books as opposed to reading?
Yeah, I'm a visual person. I'm dyslexic by nature.
Right.
So I would not thrive in a university environment or academic environment, because one, I get bored because it takes too long to learn anything. I don't need 6 months to get an idea or concept. I just need like 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's something that really intrigued me, I will go deeper. So like one of the ones I looked at was The Obstacle is the Way. It was a recent book that I went through by Ryan Holiday. And Discipline is Destiny. And so I use an app called Blinkist, an Audible.
Blinkist.
Yeah, Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T.
Okay.
I use that app. Not a plug from Blinkist, but it's great because mm-hmm. they take all the books and they summarize them into like 20-minute or less summaries, and you get all the without all the fluff.
Right.
My personality is I don't need fluff.
Right.
I just need facts.
Right.
And sometimes it works against me because, you know, if I'm dependent on my mode, if I'm in learn mode, I don't need a story. Just get to the point and tell me what it is. Right. But when I'm in the coach mode, you can take as long as you want, right? Another book that I think was Happier at Home by Gretchen Rubin was something that I just recently listened to. You know, Deep Work by Cal Newport, The Happiness Advantage, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. So anything really around personal development.
It's what you're in love with.
Yeah, I just did The Unfettered Soul also too, like about 2 days ago.
Do you have a favorite book?
Oh, my favorite book. Anything by Malcolm Gladwell, but Tipping Point and Blink by Malcolm Gladwell are my favorite books. And there's another book. I had a chance to interview him years ago, Robert Greene, The 48 Laws of Power.
Okay.
And I like that book because I think every person who's going to go into business needs to read that book because there's all these personality types. I guess Think and Grow Rich is another favorite book of mine. How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And do you know how I got into personal development?
Tell me.
My best friend, when we were younger, like in our 20s, got me into Amway.
And network marketing.
Yeah, got me into Amway. And part of their training was that you had to read all these books.
Okay.
And I started reading all these books, and I started liking the books. And we were doing okay. And then when I got separated and, you know, ultimately divorced, I just not stopped doing the business. But that's how I got into personal development.
What do you love about personal development?
It's an opportunity to grow, to become better than I was yesterday, to understand myself better, to know enough to help another person so you can help them become better. Because part of my personal mission statement, and not many people in this world have mission statements, personal ones. I've had one since 2004, 2005. And there's a part of my mission statement that I say I help people to heal and be free. That's part of my mission statement. The rest is I live my best life, I have fun and enjoy life, but I also help people to heal and be free. And I didn't realize that saying that out loud has weaved its way into my life because the gratitude movement is exactly what I'm doing. I remember my buddy, Michael, said to me, he said, man, I'm so proud of you that you started this gratitude movement. He said, I always remember you saying how you just want to help people. You want to make a difference for as many people as possible. You know, my goal is to impact the lives of 2+ billion people. I have no idea how I'm going to do that. I believe that I can.
2+ billion.
Yes. Yes, it's ambitious. I think I'm going to be greater than my father when it's all said and done. Because I'm not focused on one place. I'm focused on the planet. And so that's my crazy audacious goal is to impact the lives of 2+ billion people. I've declared it. I've said it publicly many, many times. And what I do and everything I do, I'm always helping people. Anyone ever has a conversation with me is going to walk away with value always because I share what I've learned. I share what I'm learning. I love to share information. I love to share ideas. I can sit and talk to people, complete strangers about anything positive, anything personal development, anything growth-minded, even to my level of hearing sometimes is so acute that a person will say something and I know that that's not what they're really saying. Sometimes it could be a pain in the ass too, but you know, most of the times it's pretty beautiful. What I've learned is I used to tell people everything I heard. No, I don't, because they didn't give me permission to. And so I've developed and gotten more mature as I've gotten older. Okay, and if you would like some of my help, you know, here are some things that I see that might work for you. Mm-hmm. If you don't, it's fine because you're not ready. There's nothing like trying to help someone and they're not ready. Right. You have to become willing to make the change and want to make the change. And then going back and looking at my life, I was reflecting on this as I was writing this book, because writing this book was difficult.
You had 90 days.
That was the easy part. Was the easy part. I actually did it in 5 days.
You wrote it in 5 days?
I got it all out of me in 5 days.
Okay.
Yeah, audio.
Right.
And then the editing part. I just decided that I wanted to be someone different.
Impacting 2 billion people.
Impacting 2 billion people. And I knew that in order to become that person that's going to do that I have to grow and I have to change. I am not the same person I was 20 years ago. I'm not even the same person I was 6 months ago. And those who have been around me the entire time will tell you so. I'm not even the same person I was last week, because I constantly keep evolving.
How do you begin to impact 2 billion people?
It's like the journey of 1,000 miles. You just take the first step.
What's the first step?
Well, the first step was to, one, for me, work on myself so that I could even feel like I was good enough to even start to think like that. Mm-hmm. I've always been good at networking. And I guess you can say I've always been good at putting teams together. And so I've started to build a team. In the last 3 years, I've had over 400 people apply to become volunteers. We didn't take them all. We currently have about 80 or so volunteers. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been with me since the beginning. And so I've started to create an infrastructure. The infrastructure is the foundation. We had to start with the basics, and we're still building our foundation. But if you want to do something great, you have to, one, first realize that it's going to take a team to make it happen, and it cannot be done alone. Anybody that's ever had tremendous success in their life has done it with a team.
But they have to start first.
You got to start.
Before the team.
Yeah, so you start, and then you enroll.
Right.
You start. For me, it was doing the gratitude, and as I was doing it, I felt like I wanted to share it with more people. Mm-hmm. And then I got to a point where I was like, man, this is not enough. These 50 people I'm sending it to, I want to impact thousands, and I don't know how to do that. But here's the thing. When you start, and I'm going to read, and if I can find it, I'm going to read something to you. But when you start something, you don't have to know
every
step of the way, right? Mm-hmm. You just don't. You just start, and you go, and you go, and you go. And as you travel, it's a journey. And so there's this German dude named Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Mm-hmm. And he says, until one is committed, there is hesitancy, the chance to draw back always ineffectiveness. Concerning all acts of initiative and creation, there is one elementary truth, the ignorance of which kills countless ideas and splendid plans. That the moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have occurred. A whole stream of events issues from the decision, rising in one's favor, all manner of unforeseen incidences and meetings and material assistance, which no man could have dreamt would have come his way. I have experienced this over and over and over again. And I found this when I was in my 20s.
So is that like when people go to one of these seminars with Tony Robbins and they don't know how they're going to pay for one of these courses, but they commit to doing it anyway because that commitment is the beginning of them finding a way to do it.
Right. Or another way to put it, that commitment is the start of creation. Once you make the commitment, creation can then start.
And have you found that that always ends in success for the person, or does it depend on where they are in their psyche to make that happen?
Nothing ever goes as planned.
Right.
I mean, if you've ever been in a construction business and you've ever built a house or you've ever constructed a building, you know you have a blueprint. Right. And I remember my uncle, because he was building a building one time, and I said, you know, Uncle Larry, why do you need a blueprint? And I was naive, right? And he said, because it shows you what it's supposed to look like. Doesn't mean the wall actually is 90 degrees straight up when you put the wall up, or there's flaws and things that you have to deal with and you have to adjust and compensate for, and that's life. So you just have to start. And the blueprint is the outline of what you would like it to look like. So when you want to create something for yourself, you got to create your blueprint of that, the vision of what it is that you want to create, and have some idea as to what it's going to look like. And I can tell you where we are now, just over 4 years. I didn't know that we were going to have a training team or a scheduling team or even a board of directors or any of those things. We even got a handbook that we just created. Those things came as a result of bringing team members on and collaborating, and they brought their knowledge, and as a collective, we just started to expand. All I needed to do was to enroll them in the idea that this movement is, we're creating this movement because we want to serve others, we want to make a difference. And then because I did that and they believed in it, and they can also see the vision. So when you have a team of people that can see the vision, then they bring their spin to it, and now you've got something that you could have never, ever created on your own. And that's how you do it. That's how you do it. I mean,
it's a bit like biblically, one can chase 100 and two can chase 1,000. I don't know if you remember that saying. Yeah. There's a saying in the Bible. My mom used to say it all the time, but I just can't remember it. But it's kind of similar to what I've just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with the team. It's like the oars are all going in the same direction in the boat. And even if one oar comes out of the water, the boat's still going to move forward. Because I've had oars fall out. I've had oars get broken. People are just, I'm not a rowing anymore. Once you define your mission, even the mission statement that we have, our mission at Daily Gratitude Movement is to impact every life through the power of daily gratitude. I didn't come up with that. That was a collective effort. Right. We all sat down as a board and we said, okay, we need to have direction. We need to have a mission that's going to guide us in what we are doing and what we want to create. The mission? So the mission is to impact every life through the power of daily gratitude. That's our mission. And our vision is to is creating community and empowering leaders who impact the lives of others through the power of daily gratitude. And that I see happening all the time with our volunteers. They're going into jails. They're going into nursing homes. They're going into other communities and doing other things. They're starting groups. They're becoming leaders. When we incorporate, we put down that we're an education company because we're educating people. But we're also a leadership company because we're developing leaders.
I can start my gratitude journey just by, we're in Barbados at the moment, which is an absolutely beautiful place. I come here 2 or 3 times a year and I love it. It's a fantastic place to be. And I go to the beach some mornings. I'm just grateful for the fact that I can walk on the beach. I'm in the sea. I can, all the different elements. But is that how I begin, just being grateful for aspects of my life and just doing that every day continuously?
Yeah, that's how you start.
And what happens when I come across problems? Do I do? Am I grateful for these problems or?
You should be.
I should be.
Yeah, you should be. Do you realize that no one ever grows when things are good? When life's good, you sit back and you relax and you chill.
Be grateful that there's some uncomfortability in my life.
Yeah, because that's going to be an opportunity for you to do something that you didn't do before, to learn something you didn't know before, to step out of your comfort zone. A challenge or what people call a problem is just an opportunity in disguise for you to grow. If you're up to anything big or anything substantial, you're going to have challenges. It's just part of life. If you, I go back to, you know, I was pretty elaborate with my planner and all the things that I would do. And one day I was like, man, I got this perfect date. I got it all planned out and nothing else better happened to mess up my day. And one day I said, this is like the most ridiculous, dumbest thing. I started to account for about at least 30% of my day to have problems or challenges. And ever since I've done that, I don't think I've ever really had a day that... I've had some very challenging days, but it was I reframed it to be a different experience because it was, okay, an opportunity to grow. I get excited. I don't always get excited, but it's an opportunity to grow.
One of the things that I find interesting is leadership in the Black community and personal development. Where are we with that?
It's something that I ask myself because when I look at the Tony Robbins community that I'm in, there are not many Black men, especially at trainer level. There's maybe 3 or 4. There are more Black women involved in personal development. I wonder to myself why. And I don't know what it would take for someone to feel that they could be a part of it. I don't know if it's the cost is to get into it. But here's the thing. If you want to have an extraordinary life, you're going to have to do extraordinary things. You're going to have to take a chance. A and trust the process. The environment now is talking about diversity and inclusion and want it to be a cross-section of the world and have it look like that. Now, there's people of color, but specifically I'm talking about black men. And overall, there is a shortage of leadership in the planet, in my opinion. There's not enough leaders. There's not enough people stepping up to be leaders. A lot of followers, people who are afraid to stand out. Because when you become a leader, you're not going to be popular always. And sometimes you're going to walk alone. You know, they say the higher you go, the lonelier it gets or the less crowded it is. That's true. What I would love to see happen is more people of color get involved in these types of things, because then we can bring it back to our communities. We can bring it back and we can teach our kids, we can teach our brothers and sisters how to have this amazing life. This is not an exclusive world that we live in that only certain people, because they were born looking a certain way, have access. This technology, this information is available to every single person. Yet I think that there's many people who think, well, that works for you, but it doesn't work for me. I can't have that. And if you actually go back and you study the biography of many great successful people, they started out rough. They had a challenging time. In America, where I spent most of my time, black men tend to be in church or doing other stuff and music. But we need leadership. We need examples, role models of people, of men, showing our young men how to do it. How is it done? How do you become a successful real estate developer? How do you become a successful businessman? There's no real mentorship. I think one of the things that we want to do in the gratitude movement is eventually create mentorship programs where people can come and be mentored on certain skills and abilities. If you are doing something awesome in your life, chances are it's because someone mentored you, someone taught you, or you went and got the help that you needed and you just kept at it. And I'm sure that there's probably moments where you felt totally alone when you were doing something like, who do I talk to about this? And so we need examples, and we need examples that are public. It's not just about music and movies and things like that, but you need examples of really successful. There are some successful actors and singers who are actually incredible entrepreneurs and doing wonderful things. And then we look at the professional athletes. They make a bunch of money, especially football players in soccer, not soccer, football, American football. Mm. They make a ton of money at a very young age. And then when they leave the football career, they're broke.
Yeah.
They run out of money. That's criminal.
Right. Is that because of where some of them might have come from, places where they have no knowledge of money, and then suddenly you've got this abundance and you've never been taught how to deal with it?
Yeah, I think so. If they did, it wouldn't happen. The business of football is all about making money, selling tickets for the owners so the owners can be profitable. And I think everyone is entitled to make a profit as much as they possibly can.
Mm.
And it doesn't really matter how much you make. It matters what you keep. And if you're not keeping anything, we've heard of people like Mike Tyson, who made a boatload of money and then lost it all. And now he's coming back and he's building himself back up. And there's other celebrity boxers and musicians and actors who've lost it all. It all comes down to your identity. Like, if you don't really know who you are and all of a sudden you get a ton of money, it's like winning a lottery, and you never knew how to manage it, you're going to go off and do crazy things because you've got that money now. And I don't think that the person that's selling you whatever they're selling, they want to sell you because they want to make money. Right. They want to get paid. So they're going to tell you whatever they think you want to hear.
And the thing about money is like an energy.
Yes.
And once you know how to turn it on, very difficult to turn it off.
Right.
That's always going to be a massive challenge.
Yeah. And I agree. And there are people that can teach you how to tap into that energy. And it's something that for myself personally, I'm learning. I'm shifting that perspective because it comes down to worth. I remember when I first started as a coach and they were like, okay, you got your certification. Now go out and get some clients and charge them. And man, I couldn't even charge $20 an hour. It took me a while because I didn't feel like I was worthy. And I think that we got to teach worth. We got to teach people to realize that this is what you're worth. Because when you go to someone and they say, well, this is what it costs, and they believe that that's what it costs, and if you don't have it, well, you can't buy it, you can't get it. I think we need to teach that as well to our community. We have to have value in what we do. And when you finally get to that place, and yeah, these crazy things that people think are crazy, like walking on fire, and for me, and broken glass, and eating fire, and breaking boards with my hand, and all that stuff, mm-hmm. they think is craziness, right? Like, who does that? But those things are designed to help you to break through the limiting beliefs that you have. And that's one of the reasons why they do the firework at the Tony Robbins events, because people come in thinking that they can't do something, so we've got to show you that you can do something you didn't think you can do, just to interrupt your pattern so you can actually get it done. Because once you do it, you realize, okay, wow, what else? And there's so many great people in this world that are just hiding out in the shadows.
I did the firework. At a point in your life, you're around all these people that have got this energy, and then you go back into your normal life. And really and truly, I suppose what Tony Robbins is trying to say, stay with the program.
Yeah.
Because then you're gonna keep flying. You're going to keep being around the energy.
Yeah, I 100% agree, because it happened to me. I started out as a participant. Where you entered UPW, that was me in 2004. And then I made the decision that weekend to make the investment of $10,000, right, to take the Mastery University, where there were some people in my family, they thought I was absolutely lost my mind.
Right.
I had the money only because I had taken out a loan to pay off some debt, and I decided that I was either going to pay this debt off or I was going to take this Mastery University thing and change my life forever. Had I not done that, I probably would have stayed mediocre, because I made a commitment. I had skin in the game at that point. And I went into this environment, and I started to learn, and I started to grow. And so it was like I was constantly taking steps up the stairs. Wow. And I kept going up, and I'm still going up. And once I started to do the mastery, I decided I wanted to do the leadership program, because I felt like I needed to learn the skills on how to not just lead myself, but also lead others. I didn't really want to become a leader. I just wanted the knowledge. Right. But as I went through it, I realized that I love people so much that I want to give back. And in order to do that, you have to lead yourself. I went through that process, and I became a senior. I was a senior leader for a long time, probably 17 years. And then one day, they said, you know, is anyone here want to become a trainer? If you want to become a trainer, then there's this declaration form that you need to fill out and sign. And that was that Wolfgang von Guder thing that I told you about, once you make a commitment. So I signed the form. And for the first time in my life, I'm looking at this form, and I'm like, okay, my intention is to become this. And then I got mentored. I got coaching. I got to develop my skills from event to event and in between events. And then I thought I was ready, because I had a little bit of an ego and I was a little cocky.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm ready now. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm going to get it, this event. And it didn't happen for like four or five events. And the day that I actually got the invitation and I got promoted to trainer, I cried. The only thing I could say was thank you. And I just sat there and I cried, because I had transformed myself and my abilities to a level that they thought I was worthy of it. And here I was. It took me about 3 to 4 weeks to really embrace that new role. It didn't happen overnight, because the expectation also changed as well, because now I was living at a higher standard. But it was that declaration that I made when I signed that paper and when I made that commitment to show up and that I wanted to become this, and they knew it. Then all of a sudden, Providence moves to, then I started getting mentored and coached. And they actually mentored and coached me as I went along until I developed, when they felt it was time. And it's interesting, I see it, because there's people who want this and they think they're ready, but they're not.
Right.
If you think you're ready, then you're not ready.
Right.
It's ironic, right?
Yeah.
You're ready when you don't think about it anymore. And you're living into the role. See, I was doing the role of a trainer before I became a trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I stopped thinking about it, and then I got it. It's the same thing with relationships and money and all these things. You think about it, but it comes a point where you do the work to develop yourself, and then you're not thinking about it anymore. You're thinking about the next thing you want to do, and all of a sudden, the abundance shows up.
I think it was Einstein who used to lock himself in a cupboard to get thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd lock himself away, think about something, think about it, think about it, think about it, then let it go.
Yeah.
And then when you've let it go, that's when the information and what you need comes to you.
Yeah, it was many years ago. I think it was when my dad had celebrated his 70th birthday. I had a girlfriend at the time, and she gifted me as a surprise an airline ticket to come down to see my dad for his 70th birthday. I didn't know she was going to do it. And while I was here, she broke up with me. But she didn't break up with me by saying, I break up with you. She broke up with me by saying, I don't think I'm the one for you. And I want to know that it's okay with you if I can move on. She asked for permission to break up with me. No one's ever done that before.
Right.
And I said, well, I can't stop you from doing this. And then in my journey of that, the day before I was to come back to the States, I wrote this short story called Bluebird's Flight to Freedom. Mm-hmm. And in there, I made an analogy of breathing, right? So breathing oxygen, air, is probably the most vital thing. Without, we're going to die. So you would think that we should accumulate air and store it someplace. We should have a canister in our house with all the air that we would ever need. Mm-hmm. But we don't do that, right? We just breathe in and out as a result of our existence. And so the thing that's so precious to you, you can't hold on to it. You've got to take it in, and you've got to let it go. Right. And when you do that with everything else in your life, you just take it in and you let it go. It keeps coming back. And we keep breathing in and out until we no longer cease to exist. And that's kind of a philosophy that I've adopted. So I do my best not to want to hold on to anything.
That sounds like a very difficult thing to do. Mm-hmm. There's lots of people who shallow breathe. They're not actually breathing.
Yeah, from that standpoint, but I'm not even talking that. I'm just talking the gift of breath. You can't hold your breath indefinitely. So the thing that gives you life...
is your breath.
Is your breath. And it comes and goes. There's an exchange.
Right.
And it's in that exchange that you live. And that's what I'm talking about in terms of letting go of these things that are holding you back. The freer you become, the more things you let go, the more... better quality life you're going to have. And you said it's not easy. I mean, you have to become conscious of it. It's like you want to create something, mm-hmm. but you're afraid to start. So you've got to let go of the fear.
And then you can create.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
I believe in butterflies. The night that my sister died, I saw a butterfly fly out of the wall, across and back, and disappeared. And I believe that that was her divine energy transitions to wherever it was going to go. And I don't know why I was the only one that saw it, but I saw it as clearly as I'm seeing you right now. Ever since then, her tombstone has butterflies on it. A butterfly appeared on my dashboard of my car 5 days before the anniversary of her death. I don't even know how it got in the car. And my mother, in a conversation with her, she said to me, always follow your butterfly. I don't know what made her say that to me. And that is what I've been doing for the last 10 years, is following my butterfly. This past Monday, I had a coaching session back in 2015. My sister died in 2013. And the person that had the session mailed me a physical, not email, mailed me her handwritten notes. I opened the envelope. And I just peeked in to just see that what it was, but because I knew when, by the time I got it, I still kind of remembered. And then I completely forgot what we talked about. And I just was going through some papers, and I found this envelope, and something just said, pick it up. I picked it up. I pulled it out. I read her notes. And I was like, it was almost like I wrote that. That was in 2015, was written for today.
Right.
And then when I dumped out the envelope, there was a card. That I didn't even see the card before. There were two butterflies on the card and a note that says, I believe in you and I'm grateful for you. And then there were two little angels, and then there was a metal butterfly that said, spread your wings. I had not heard from that person probably since 2015, and I called a mutual friend of ours, and she didn't get back to me, and I went and found out she passed away in 2022. So it is even more powerful what I read. And so that's on my desk right now with this little metal butterfly. In the gratitude movement, part of our symbol of our logo is a butterfly. And so for me, I am a butterfly person and I follow butterflies. And the butterfly is going to take me to the 2+ billion people that I want to reach. Follow your butterfly.
Follow your butterfly. Finally, what message would you give to the people of Barbados about this gratitude movement that you're involved in? Will they be surprised if they hear this side of you?
Well, I think that some people might be surprised. I mean, the people who know me closely, they wouldn't be surprised because they already know. I've become more public about my personal life and things that I'm going through because I realize that I do not want to be a hostage to my past. I do not want to be a hostage to anyone or anything. And there's freedom when you can let yourself go and you can just talk about whatever you want to talk about. And when you don't, when what someone else thinks about you doesn't matter, you are really free, man. Because what they think about you, I have no control over. So why fret and fuss over it? So you don't like me? Okay.
So before this gratitude movement, did you fret and worry about?
I'd be worried about that. Because, you know, go back to that primary question thing I talked about. My old primary question, which is something that you experienced in a Tony Robbins program called Date with Destiny, was how can I not look stupid? So can you imagine having that as an identity? You don't take any chance. You don't take any risk. You don't step out of your comfort zone. You don't do anything. You play it safe all the time. Mm-hmm. And I replaced that with how can I share my gifts now? How can I share my gifts now? That gives me courage. It gives me strength. It gives me an identity. It sets a path for me to walk. When I have a conversation, it doesn't mean I don't experience fear. I still experience fear, but a different kind of fear. And I'm still evolving. I haven't arrived. I don't have every single thing that I want, and I'm not doing every single thing that I want to do. I'm busier now than I've ever been in my life. I mean, I feel like some of my friends are like, dude, you don't have an off switch. When do you stop? Right? But I feel like I'm up to, I have a purpose, I have a mission, and I'm not going to stop until it's done.
Where can we find this gratitude movement if people want to tune in and connect?
Yeah, well, you can find the gratitude movement at dailygratitudemovement.org or the short version, dgm365.org, which is the daily...
dgm365.org.
Yeah, or that. You can find us there. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter under my name, Gar Sandiford. My website's coming back online of rebranding as myself as a coach mm-hmm. instead of a realtor. Mm-hmm. So that's coming back. And you can find me there as well, garsandiford.com.
What's the thing that you're most grateful for right now?
Well, that I stuck it out. I didn't give up. Right. That I'm beginning to believe in myself more than I did 20 years ago, that I can do difficult things. And I think I'm grateful for my mother and my father because I wouldn't be here if it weren't for them. So it's not just one thing, but really, if I had to just pick one, I'm grateful that I'm alive today because I get to do something.
Garf, thank you very much for your time today. This has been an incredible conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.